he asked.
It is, the goddess answered.
Something fell from a long height in my chest. Achilles turned to me as if he would speak, but his mother was faster.
You are bound to us now, King Lycomedes. You will continue to shelter Achilles here. You will say nothing of who he is. In return, your daughter will one day be able to claim a famous husband.
Her eyes went to a point above Deidamia's head, then back. She added,
It is better than she would have done.
Lycomedes rubbed at his neck as if he would smooth its wrinkles.
I have no choice, he said, as you know.
What if I will not be silent?
Deidamia's color was high.
You have ruined me, you and your son. I have lain with him, as you told me to, and my honor is gone. I will claim him now, before the court, as recompense.
I have lain with him.
You are a foolish girl, Thetis said.
Each word fell like an axe blade, sharp and severing.
Poor and ordinary, an expedient only. You do not deserve my son. You will keep your peace, or I will keep it for you.
Deidamia stepped backwards, her eyes wide, her lips gone white. Her hands were trembling. She lifted one to her stomach and clutched the fabric of her dress there, as if to steady herself. Outside the palace, beyond the cliffs, we could hear huge waves breaking on the rocks, dashing the shoreline to pieces.
I am pregnant,
the princess whispered. I was watching Achilles when she said it. I saw the horror on his face. Lycomedes made a noise of pain. My chest felt hollowed and eggshell thin. Enough. Perhaps I said it, perhaps I only thought it. I let go of Achilles' hand and strode to the door. Thetis must have moved aside for me. I would have run into her if she had not. Alone, I stepped into the darkness.
Wait!
Achilles shouted. It took him longer to reach me than it should have, I noted with detachment. The dress must be tangling his legs. He caught up to me, seized my arm.
Let go, I said. Please wait. Please let me explain. I did not want to do it. My mother!
He was breathless, almost panting. I had never seen him so upset.
She led the girl to my room. She made me. I did not want to. My mother said. She said.
He was stumbling over his words.
She said that if I did as she said, she would tell you where I was.
What had Deidamia thought would happen, I wondered, when she had her women dance for me? Had she really thought I would not know him? I could recognize him by touch alone, by smell. I would know him blind, by the way his breaths came and his feet struck the earth. I would know him in death, at the end of the world.
Patroclus.
He cupped my cheek with his hand.
Do you hear me? Please, say something.
I could not stop imagining her skin beside his, her swelling breasts and curving hips. I remembered the long days I grieved for him, my hands empty and idle, plucking the air like birds peck at dry earth.
Patroclus?
You did it for nothing. He flinched at the emptiness of my voice, but how else was I to sound?
What do you mean?
Your mother did not tell me where you were. It was Peleus. His face had gone pale, bled dry.
She did not tell you?
No.
Did you truly expect she would?
My voice cut harder than I meant it to.
Yes, he whispered.
There were a thousand things I might have said. To reproach him for his naivety. He had always trusted too easily. He had had so little in his life to fear or suspect. In the days before our friendship, I had almost hated him for this, and some old spark of that flared in me, trying to relight. Anyone else would have known that Thetis acted for her own purposes only. How could he be so foolish? The angry words pricked in my mouth. But when I tried to speak them, I found I could not. His cheeks were flushed with shame, and the skin beneath his eyes was weary. His trust was a part of him, as much as his hands or his miraculous feet. Despite my hurt, I would not wish to see it gone, to see him as uneasy and fearful as the rest of us, for any price. He was watching me closely, reading my face over and over, like a priest searching the auguries for an answer. I could see the slight line in his forehead that meant utmost concentration. Something shifted in me then, like the frozen surface of the Apidanos in spring. I had seen the way he looked at Deidamia, or rather, the way he did not. It was the same way he had looked at the boys in Thyre, blank and unseeing. He had never, not once, looked at me that way.
"Forgive me," he said again. "I did not want it. It was not you. I did not like it."
Hearing it soothed the last of the jagged grief that had begun when Deidamia shouted his name. My throat was thick with the beginning of tears.
"There is nothing to forgive," I said.
Later that evening, we returned to the palace. The great hall was dark, its fire burned to embers. Achilles had repaired his dress as best he could, but it still gaped to the waist. He held it closed in case we met a lingering guard. The voice came from the shadows, startling us.
"You have returned."
The moonlight did not quite reach the thrones, but we saw the outline of a man there, thick with furs. His voice seemed deeper than it had before, heavier.
"We have," Achilles said.
I could hear the slight hesitation before he answered. He had not expected to face the king again so soon.
"Your mother is gone. I do not know where."
The king paused, as if awaiting a response. Achilles said nothing.
"My daughter, your wife, is in her room crying. She hopes you will come to her."
I felt the flinch of Achilles' guilt. His words came out stiffly. It was not a feeling he was used to.
"It is unfortunate that she hopes for this." "It is indeed," Lycomedes said.
We stood in silence a moment, then Lycomedes drew a weary breath.
"I suppose that you want a room for your friend, if you do not mind," Achilles said carefully.
Lycomedes let out a soft laugh.
"No, Prince Achilles, I do not mind."
There was another silence. I heard the king lift a goblet, drink, replace it on the table.
"The child must have your name. You understand this?"
This is what he had waited in the dark to say, beneath his furs by the dying fire.
"I understand it," Achilles said quietly. "And you swear it."
There was a hair's breadth of a pause. I pitied the old king. I was glad when Achilles said,
"I swear it."
The old man made a sound like a sigh, but his words, when they came, were formal. He was a king again.
"Good night to you both."
We bowed and left him. In the bowels of the palace, Achilles found a guard to show us to the guest quarters. The voice he used was high and fluting, his girl's voice. I saw the guard's eyes flicker over him, lingering on the torn edges of the dress, his disheveled hair. He grinned at me with all his teeth.
"Right away, mistress," he said.
In the stories, the gods have the power to delay the moon's course if they wish, to spin a single night the length of many. Such was this night, a bounty of hours that never ran dry. We drank deeply, thirsty for all that we had missed in the weeks we were separated. It was not until the sky began to blanch at last to grey that I remembered what he had said to Lycomedes in the hall. It had been forgotten amidst Deidamia's pregnancy, his marriage, our reunion.
"Your mother was trying to hide you from the war?"
He nodded.
"She does not want me to go to Troy."
"Why? I had always thought she wanted him to fight."
"I don't know. She says I'm too young. Not yet, she says."
and it was her idea. I gestured at the remnants of the dress. Of course, I wouldn't have done it myself. He made a face and yanked at his hair, hanging still in its womanly curls. An irritant, but not a crippling shame, as it would have been to another boy. He did not fear ridicule. He had never known it. Anyway, it is only until the army leaves. My mind struggled with this. So truly, it was not because of me that she took you.
Deidamia was because of you, I think.
He stared at his hands a moment.
But the rest was the war.
Chapter 13. The next days passed quietly. We took meals in our room and spent long hours away from the palace, exploring the island, seeking what shade there was beneath the scruffy trees. We had to be careful. Achilles could not be seen moving too quickly, climbing too skillfully, holding a spear. But we were not followed, and there were many places where he could safely let his disguise drop. On the far side of the island, there was a deserted stretch of beach, rock-filled but twice the size of our running tracks. Achilles made a sound of delight when he saw it and tore off his dress. I watched him race across it, as swiftly as if the beach had been flat.
"Count for me,"
he shouted over his shoulder. I did, tapping against the sand to keep the time.
"How many?"
he called from the beach's end.
13,
I called back.
"I'm just warming up," he said.
The next time it was 11, the last time it was 9. He sat down next to me, barely winded, his cheeks flushed with joy. He had told me of his days as a woman, the long hours of enforced tedium, with only the dances for relief. Free now, he stretched his muscles like one of Pelion's mountain cats, luxuriant in his own strength. In the evenings, though, we had to return to the great hall. Reluctant, Achilles would put on his dress and smooth back his hair. Often he bound it up in cloth, as he had that first night. Golden hair was uncommon enough to be remarked upon by the sailors and merchants who passed through our harbour. If their tales found the ears of someone clever enough, I did not like to think of it. A table was set for us at the front of the hall near the thrones. We ate there, the four of us, Lycomedes, Deidamia, Achilles and I. Sometimes we were joined by a counselor or two, sometimes not. These dinners were mostly silent. They were for form, to quell gossip and maintain the fiction of Achilles as my wife and the king's ward. Deidamia's eyes darted eagerly towards him, hoping he would look at her, but he never did.
"Good evening,"
he would say in his proper girl's voice as we sat, but nothing more. His indifference was a palpable thing, and I saw her pretty face flinch through emotions of shame and hurt and anger. She kept looking to her father, as if she hoped he might intervene. But Lycomedes put bite after bite in his mouth and said nothing. Sometimes she saw me watching her. Her face would grow hard then, and her eyes would narrow. She put a hand on her belly, possessively, as if to ward off some spell I might cast. Perhaps she thought I was mocking her, flourishing my triumph. Perhaps she thought I hated her. She did not know that I almost asked him 100 times to be a little kinder to her. "You do not have to humiliate her so thoroughly," I thought. But it was not kindness he lacked, it was interest. His gaze passed over her as if she were not there. Once she tried to speak to him, her voice trembling with hope.
"Are you well, Pyrrha?"
He continued eating in his elegant, swift bites. He and I had planned to take spears to the far side of the island after dinner and catch fish by moonlight. He was eager to be gone. I had to nudge him beneath the table.
"What is it?"
he asked me. "The princess wants to know if you are well."
"Oh,"
he glanced at her briefly, then back to me.
"I am well," he said.
As the days wore on, Achilles took to waking early so that he might practice with spears before the sun rose high. We had hidden weapons in a distant grove, and he would exercise there before returning to womanhood in the palace. Sometimes he might visit his mother afterwards, sitting on one of Skyros's jagged rocks, dangling his feet into the sea. It was one of these mornings, when Achilles was gone, that there was a loud rap on my door. "Yes?" I called, but the guards were already stepping inside. They were more formal than I had ever seen them, carrying spears and standing at attention. It was strange to see them without their dice.
"You're to come with us," one of them said.
"Why?" I was barely out of bed and still bleary with sleep.
"The princess ordered it."
A guard took each of my arms and towed me to the door. When I stuttered a protest, the first guard leaned towards me, his eyes on mine.
"It will be better if you go quietly."
He drew his thumb over his spear point in theatrical menace. I did not really think they would hurt me, but neither did I want to be dragged through the halls of the palace. "All right," I said. The narrow corridors where they led me I had never visited before. They were the women's quarters, twisting off from the main rooms, a beehive of narrow cells where Deidamia's foster sisters slept and lived. I heard laughter from behind the doors, and the endless shush-shush of the shuttle. Achilles said that the sun did not come through the windows here, and there was no breeze. He had spent nearly 2 months in them. I could not imagine it. At last we came to a large door, cut from finer wood than the rest. The guard knocked on it, opened it, and pushed me through. I heard it close firmly behind me. Inside, Deidamia was seated primly on a leather-covered chair regarding me. There was a table beside her, and a small stool at her feet, otherwise the room was empty. She must have planned this, I realized. She knew that Achilles was away. There was no place for me to sit, so I stood. The floor was cold stone and my feet were bare. There was a second, smaller door. It led to her bedroom, I guessed. She watched me looking, her eyes bright as a bird's. There was nothing clever to say, so I said something foolish. "You wanted to speak with me?" She sniffed a little with contempt.
"Yes, Patroclus, I wanted to speak with you."
I waited, but she said nothing more, only studied me, a finger tapping the arm of her chair. Her dress was looser than usual. She did not have it tied across the waist as she often did, to show her figure. Her hair was unbound and held back at the temples with carved ivory combs. She tilted her head and smiled at me.
"You are not even handsome. That is the funny thing. You are quite ordinary."
She had her father's way of pausing as if she expected a reply. I felt myself flushing. I must say something. I cleared my throat. She glared at me.
"I have not given you leave to speak."
She held my gaze a moment, as if to make sure that I would not disobey, then continued.
"I think it's funny. Look at you."
She rose, and her quick steps ate up the space between us.
"Your neck is short. Your chest is thin as a boy's."
She gestured at me with disdainful fingers.
"And your face,"
she grimaced.
"Hideous. My women quite agree. Even my father agrees."
Her pretty red lips parted to show her white teeth. It was the closest I had ever been to her. I could smell something sweet, like a acanthus flower. Close up, I could see that her hair was not just black, but shot through with shifting colors of rich brown.
"Well, what do you say?"
Her hands were on her hips. "You have not given me leave to speak," I said. Anger flashed over her face.
"Don't be an idiot," she spat at me.
I wasn't. She slapped me. Her hand was small but carried surprising force. It turned my head to the side roughly. The skin stung, and my lip throbbed sharply where she had caught it with a ring. I had not been struck like this since I was a child. Boys were not usually slapped, but a father might do it to show contempt. Mine had. It shocked me. I could not have spoken even if I had known what to say. She bared her teeth at me, as if daring me to strike her in return. When she saw I would not, her face twisted with triumph.
"Coward!
as craven as you are ugly. And half moron besides, I hear. I do not understand it. It makes no sense that he should... She stopped abruptly, and the corner of her mouth tugged down as if caught by a fisherman's hook. She turned her back to me and was silent. A moment passed. I could hear the sound of her breaths, drawn slowly, so I would not guess she was crying. I knew the trick. I had done it myself. "I hate you," she said. But her voice was thick, and there was no force in it. A sort of pity rose in me, cooling the heat of my cheeks. I remembered how hard a thing indifference was to bear. I heard her swallow, and her hand move swiftly to her face, as if to wipe away tears.
"I'm leaving tomorrow," she said.
"That should make you happy.
My father wants me to begin my confinement early. He says it would bring shame upon me for the pregnancy to be seen before it was known I was married."
Confinement. I heard the bitterness in her voice when she said it. Some small house at the edge of Lycomedes' land. She would not be able to dance or speak with companions there. She would be alone with a servant and her growing belly. "I'm sorry," I said. She did not answer. I watched the soft heaving of her back beneath the white gown. I took a step towards her, then stopped. I had thought to touch her, to smooth her hair in comfort, but it would not be comfort from me. My hand fell back to my side. We stood there like that for some time, the sound of our breaths filling the chamber. When she turned, her face was ruddy from crying.
"Achilles does not regard me."
Her voice trembled a little.
"Even though I bear his child and am his wife. Do you know why this is so?"
It was a child's question, like why the rain falls or why the sea's motion never ceases. I felt older than her, though I was not. "I do not know," I said softly. Her face twisted. "That's a lie. You're the reason. You will sail with him, and I will be left here." I knew something of what it was to be alone, of how another's good fortune pricked like a goad. But there was nothing I could do. "I should go," I said, as gently as I could. "No!" She moved quickly to block my way. Her words tumbled out. "You cannot. I will call the guards if you try. I will. I will say you attacked me." Sorrow for her dragged at me, bearing me down. Even if she called them, even if they believed her, they could not help her. I was the companion of Achilles, and invulnerable. My feelings must have shown on my face. She recoiled from me as if stung, and the heat sparked in her again. "You were angry that he married me, that he lay with me. You were jealous. You should be." Her chin lifted, as it used to. "It was not just once." "It was twice. Achilles had told me. She thought that she had power to drive a wedge between us, but she had nothing." "I'm sorry," I said again. I had nothing better to say. He did not love her. He never would. As if she heard my thought, her face crumpled. Her tears fell on the floor, turning the grey stone black, drop by drop. "Let me get your father," I said, "or one of your women." She looked up at me. "Please," she whispered. "Please do not leave." She was shivering like something just born. Always before, her hurts had been small, and there had been someone to offer her comfort. Now, there was only this room, the bare walls and single chair, the closet of her grief. Almost unwillingly, I stepped towards her. She gave a small sigh, like a sleepy child, and drooped gratefully into the circle of my arms. Her tears bled through my tunic. I held the curves of her waist, felt the warm, soft skin of her arms. He had held her just like this, perhaps. But Achilles seemed a long way off. His brightness had no place in this dull, weary room. Her face, hot as if with fever, pressed against my chest. All I could see of her was the top of her head, the whirl and tangle of her shining dark hair, the pale scalp beneath. After a time, her sobs subsided, and she drew me closer. I felt her hands stroking my back, the length of her body pressing to mine. At first I did not understand. Then I did. "You do not want this," I said. I made to step back, but she held me too tightly.
"I do."
Her eyes had an intensity to them that almost frightened me. "Deidamia," I tried to summon the voice I had used to make Peleus yield. "The guards are outside. You must not..." But she was calm now, and sure.
"They will not disturb us."
I swallowed, my throat dry with panic.
"Achilles will be looking for me."
She smiled sadly.
"He will not look here."
She took my hand.
"Come," she said,
and drew me through her bedroom's door. Achilles had told me about their nights together when I asked. It had not been awkward for him to do so. Nothing was forbidden between us. Her body, he said, was soft and small as a child's. She had come to his cell at night with his mother and lain beside him on the bed. He had feared he would hurt her. It had been swift, and neither spoke. He floundered as he tried to describe the heavy, thick smell, the wetness between her legs. "Greasy," he said, "like oil." When I pressed him further, he shook his head. "I cannot remember, really. It was dark, and I could not see. I wanted it to be over." He stroked my cheek. "I missed you." The door closed behind us, and we were alone in a modest room. The walls were hung with tapestries, and the floor was thick with sheepskin rugs. There was a bed, pushed against the window, to catch the hint of breeze. She pulled her dress over her head and dropped it on the floor.
"Do you think I am beautiful?"
she asked me. I was grateful for a simple answer. "Yes," I said. Her body was small and delicately made, with just the barest rise of belly where the child grew. My eyes were drawn down to what I had never seen before, a small furred area, the dark hairs spreading lightly upwards. She saw me looking. Reaching for my hand, she guided me to that place, which radiated heat like the embers of a fire. The skin that slipped against my fingers was warm and delicate, so fragile I was almost afraid I would tear it with my touch. My other hand reached up to stroke her cheek, to trace the softness beneath her eyes. The look in them was terrible to see. There was no hope or pleasure, only determination. Almost I fled, but I could not bear to see her face broken open with more sorrow, more disappointment, another boy who could not give her what she wanted. So I allowed her hands, fumbling a little, to draw me to the bed, to guide me between her thighs, where tender skin parted, weeping slow, warm drops. I felt resistance and would have drawn back, but she shook her head sharply. Her small face was tight with concentration, her jaw set as if against pain. It was a relief for us both when at last the skin eased, gave way, when I slipped into that sheathing warmth within her. I will not say I was not aroused. A slow, climbing tension moved through me. It was a strange, drowsy feeling, so different from my sharp, sure desires for Achilles. She seemed hurt by this, my heavy-lidded response. More indifference. And so I let myself move, made sounds of pleasure, pressed my chest against hers as if in passion, flattening her soft, small breasts beneath me. She was pleased then, suddenly fierce, pulling and pushing me harder and faster, her eyes lighting in triumph at the changes in my breath. And then, at the slow rising of tide inside me, her legs, light but firm, wrapped around my back, bucking me into her, drawing out the spasm of my pleasure. Afterwards, we lay breathless, side by side but not touching. Her face was shadowed and distant, her posture strangely stiff. My mind was still muddied from climax, but I reached to hold her. I could offer her this, at least. But she drew away from me and stood, her eyes wary. The skin beneath them was dark as bruises. She turned to dress, and her round heart-shaped buttocks stared at me like a reproach. I did not understand what she had wanted. I only knew I had not given it. I stood and pulled on my tunic. I would have touched her, stroked her face, but her eyes warned me away, sharp and full. She held open the door. Hopelessly, I stepped over the threshold.
"Wait."
Her voice sounded raw. I turned.
"Tell him goodbye,"
she said, and then closed the door, dark and thick between us. When I found Achilles again, I pressed myself to him in relief at the joy between us, at being released from her sadness and hurt. Later, I almost convinced myself it had not happened, that it had been a vivid dream drawn from his descriptions and too much imagination. But that is not the truth. Chapter 14. Deidamia left the next morning, as she had said she would.
"She is visiting an aunt,"
Lycomedes told the court at breakfast, his voice flat. If there were questions, no one dared to ask them. She would be gone until the child was born, and Achilles could be named as father. The weeks that passed now felt curiously suspended. Achilles and I spent as much time as possible away from the palace, and our joy, so explosive at our reunion, had been replaced with impatience. We wanted to leave, to return to our lives on Pelion or in Thyre. We felt furtive and guilty with the princess gone. The court's eyes on us had sharpened, grown uncomfortable. Lycomedes frowned whenever he saw us. And then there was the war. Even here in far-off forgotten Skyros, news came of it. Helen's former suitors had honored their vow, and Agamemnon's army was rich with princely blood. It was said that he had done what no man before him could, united our fractious kingdoms with common cause. I remembered him, a grim-faced shadow, shaggy as a bear. To my 9-year-old self, his brother Menelaus had been much the more memorable of the two, with his red hair and merry voice. But Agamemnon was older, and his armies the larger. He would lead the expedition to Troy. It was morning, and late winter, though it did not seem it. So far south, the leaves did not fall and no frost pinched the morning air. We lingered in a rock cleft that looked over the span of horizon, watching idly for ships or the grey flash of Dolphin Back. We hurled pebbles from the cliff, leaning over to watch them skitter down the rock face. We were high enough that we could not hear the sound of them breaking on the rocks below.
"I wish I had your mother's lyre," he said.
"Me too." But it was in Thyre, left behind with everything else. We were silent a moment, remembering the sweetness of its strings. He leaned forward.
"What is that?"
I squinted. The sun sat differently on the horizon now that it was winter, seeming to slant into my eyes from every angle. I cannot tell. I stared at the haze where the sea vanished into the sky. There was a distant smudge that might have been a ship or a trick of the sun on the water. "If it's a ship, there will be news," I said, with a familiar clutch in my stomach. Each time I feared word would come of a search for the last of Helen's suitors, the Oathbreaker. I was young then. It did not occur to me that no leader would wish it known that some had not obeyed his summons.
"It is a ship, for certain," Achilles said.
The smudge was closer now. The ship must be moving very quickly. The bright colors of the sail resolved themselves moment by moment out of the sea's blue-gray.
"Not a trader," Achilles commented.
Trading ships used white sails only, practical and cheap. A man needed to be rich indeed to waste his dye on sailcloth. Agamemnon's messengers had crimson and purple sails, symbols stolen from Eastern royalty. This ship's sails were yellow, whirled with patterns of black. "Do you know the design?" I asked. Achilles shook his head. We watched the ship skirt the narrow mouth of Skyros's bay and beach itself on the sandy shore. A rough-cut stone anchor was heaved overboard, the gangway lowered. We were too far to see much of the men on its deck, beyond dark heads. We had stayed longer than we should have. Achilles stood and tucked his wind-loosened hair back beneath its kerchief. My hands busied themselves with the folds of his dress, settling them more gracefully across his shoulders, fastening the belts and laces. It was barely strange anymore to see him in it. When we were finished, Achilles bent towards me for a kiss. His lips on mine were soft and stirred me. He caught the expression in my eyes and smiled. "Later," he promised me, then turned and went back down the path to the palace. He would go to the women's quarters and wait there, amidst the looms and the dresses, until the messenger was gone. The hairline cracks of a headache were beginning behind my eyes. I went to my bedroom, cool and dark, its shutters barring the midday sun, and slept. A knock woke me. A servant, perhaps, or Lycomedes. My eyes still closed, I called. "Come in." "It's rather too late for that," a voice answered. The tone was amused, dry as driftwood. I opened my eyes and sat up. A man stood inside the open door. He was sturdy and muscular, with a close-cropped philosopher's beard, dark brown tinged with faintest red. He smiled at me, and I saw the lines where other smiles had been. It was an easy motion for him, swift and practiced. Something about it tugged at my memory. "I'm sorry if I disturbed you." His voice was pleasant, well modulated. "It's all right," I said carefully. "I was hoping I might have a word with you. Do you mind if I sit?" He gestured towards a chair with a wide palm. The request was politely made. Despite my unease, I could find no reason to refuse him. I nodded, and he drew the chair to him. His hands were calloused and rough. They would not have looked out of place holding a plough, yet his manner bespoke nobility. To stall, I stood and opened the shutters, hoping my brain would shake off its sleepy fog. I could think of no reason that any man would want a moment of my time, unless he had come to claim me for my oath. I turned to face him. "Who are you?" I asked. The man laughed. "Good question. I've been terribly rude, barging into your room like this. I am one of the great King Agamemnon's captains. I travel the islands and speak to promising young men such as yourself." He inclined his head towards me. "About joining our army against Troy. Have you heard of the war?" "I have heard of it," I said. "Good." He smiled and stretched his feet in front of him. The fading light fell on his legs, revealing a pink scar that seamed the brown flesh of his right calf from ankle to knee. A pink scar. My stomach dropped as if I leaned over Skyros's highest cliff with nothing beneath me but the long fall to the sea. He was older now and larger, come into the full flush of his strength. Odysseus. He said something, but I did not hear it. I was back in Tyndareus's hall, remembering his clever dark eyes that missed nothing. Did he know me? I stared at his face, but saw only a slightly puzzled expectation. He is waiting for an answer. I forced down my fear. "I'm sorry," I said. I did not hear you. "What? Are you interested in joining us to fight?" "I don't think you'd want me. I'm not a very good soldier." His mouth twisted wryly. "It's funny. No one seems to be when I come calling." His tone was light. It was a shared joke, not a reproach. "What's your name?" I tried to sound as casual as he. "Chironides." "Chironides," he repeated. I watched him for disbelief, but saw none. The tension in my muscles ebbed a little. Of course he did not recognize me. I had changed much since I was 9.
Well, Chironides, Agamemnon promises gold and honor for all who fight for him. The campaign looks to be short. We will have you back home by next fall. I will be here for a few days, and I hope you will consider it.
He dropped his hands to his knees with finality and stood. That's it? I had expected persuasion and pressure, a long evening of it. He laughed almost affectionately. Yes, that's it. I assume I will see you at dinner. I nodded. He made as if to go, then stopped.
You know, it's funny. I keep thinking I've seen you before.
I doubt it, I said quickly. I don't recognize you. He studied me a moment, then shrugged, giving up. I must be confusing you with another young man. You know what they say, the older you get, the less you remember. He scratched his beard thoughtfully.
Who's your father? Perhaps it's him I know.
I am an exile. He made a sympathetic face.
I'm sorry to hear it. Where were you from?
The coast.
North or south?
South. He shook his head ruefully.
I would have sworn you were from the north. Somewhere near Thessaly, say. Or Thyre. You have the same roundness to your vowels that they do.
I swallowed. In Thyre, the consonants were harder than elsewhere, and the vowels wider. It had sounded ugly to me, until I heard Achilles speak. I had not realized how much of it I had adopted.
I did not know that, I mumbled.
My heart was beating very fast.
If only he would leave.
Useless information is my curse, I'm afraid.
He was amused again, that slight smile.
Now don't forget to come find me if you decide you want to join us. Or if you happen to know of any other likely young men I should speak to.
The door snicked shut behind him. The dinner bell had rung, and the corridors were busy with servants carrying platters and chairs. When I stepped into the hall, my visitor was already there, standing with Lycomedes and another man.
Chironides? Lycomedes acknowledged my arrival. This is Odysseus, ruler of Ithaca.
Thank goodness for hosts, Odysseus said. I realized after I left that I never told you my name.
And I did not ask because I knew. It had been a mistake, but was not irreparable. I widened my eyes.
You're a king.
I dropped to a knee in my best startled obeisance.
Actually, he's only a prince, a voice drawled. I'm the one who's a king.
I looked up to meet the third man's eyes. They were a brown so light it was almost yellow and keen. His beard was short and black, and it emphasized the slanting planes of his face.
This is Lord Diomedes, king of Argos, Lycomedes said, a comrade of Odysseus.
And another suitor of Helen's, though I remembered no more than his name.
Lord?
I bowed to him. I did not have time to fear recognition. He had already turned away.
Well,
Lycomedes gestured to the table.
Shall we eat?
For dinner, we were joined by several of Lycomedes' counselors, and I was glad to vanish among them. Odysseus and Diomedes largely ignored us, absorbed in talk with the king.
And how is Ithaca?
Lycomedes asked politely.
Ithaca as well, thank you, Odysseus answered. I left my wife and son there, both in good health.
Ask him about his wife, Diomedes said. He loves to talk about her. Have you heard how he met her? It's his favorite story.
There was a goading edge to his voice, barely sheathed. The men around me stopped eating to watch. Lycomedes looked between the two men, then ventured,
And how did you meet your wife, Prince of Ithaca?
If Odysseus felt the tension, he did not show it.
You are kind to ask.
When Tyndareus sought a husband for Helen, suitors came from every kingdom, I'm sure you remember.
I was married already, Lycomedes said. I did not go.
Of course.
and these were too young, I'm afraid. He tossed a smile at me, then turned back to the king. Of all these men, I was fortunate to arrive first. The king invited me to dine with the family, Helen, her sister Clytemnestra, and their cousin Penelope.
Invited? Diomedes scoffed. Is that what they call crawling through the bracken to spy upon them?
I'm sure the Prince of Ithaca would not do such a thing, Lycomedes frowned.
Unfortunately, I did just that, though I appreciate your faith in me. He offered Lycomedes a genial smile. It was Penelope who caught me, actually. Said she had been watching me for over an hour and thought she should step in before I hit the thorn bush. Naturally, there was some awkwardness about it, but Tyndareus eventually came around and asked me to stay. In the course of dinner, I came to see that Penelope was twice as clever as her cousins and just as beautiful.
So, as beautiful as Helen? Diomedes interrupted. Is that why she was 20 and unmarried?
Odysseus's voice was mild. I'm sure you would not ask a man to compare his wife unfavorably to another woman, he said. Diomedes rolled his eyes and settled back to pick his teeth with the point of his knife. Odysseus returned to Lycomedes.
So, in the course of our conversation, when it became clear that the Lady Penelope favored me...
Not for your looks, certainly,
Diomedes commented.
Certainly not, Odysseus agreed.
She asked me what wedding present I would make to my bride.
A wedding bed, I said, rather gallantly, of finest home oak. But this answer did not please her. A wedding bed should not be made of dead, dry wood, but something green and living, she told me. And what if I can make such a bed, I said. Will you have me? And she said,
the king of Argos made a noise of disgust.
I'm sick to death of this tale about your marriage bed.
And perhaps you shouldn't have suggested I tell it.
And perhaps you should get some new stories so I don't fucking kill myself of boredom.
Lycomedes looked shocked. Obscenity was for back rooms and practice fields, not state dinners. But Odysseus only shook his head sadly. Truly, the men of Argos get more and more barbaric with each passing year. Lycomedes, let us show the king of Argos a bit of civilization. I was hoping for a glimpse of the famous dancers of your isle. Lycomedes swallowed.
Yes, he said. I had not thought...
He stopped himself, then began again with the most kingly voice he could summon.
If you wish.
We do.
This was Diomedes.
Well,
Lycomedes' eyes darted between the two men. Thetis had ordered him to keep the women away from visitors, but to refuse would be suspicious. He cleared his throat, decided,
well, let us call them then.
He gestured sharply at a servant, who turned and ran from the hall. I kept my eyes on my plate, so they would not see the fear in my face. The women had been surprised by the summons and were still making small adjustments of clothes and hair as they entered the hall. Achilles was among them, his head carefully covered, his gaze modestly down. My eyes went anxiously to Odysseus and Diomedes, but neither even glanced at him. The girls took their places, and the music was struck. We watched as they began the complicated series of steps. It was beautiful, though lessened by Deidamia's absence. She had been the best of them.
Which one is your daughter?
Diomedes asked.
She is not here, King of Argos. She is visiting family.
Too bad, Diomedes said. I hoped it was that one.
He pointed to a girl on the end, small and dark. She did look something like Deidamia, and her ankles were particularly lovely, flashing beneath the whirling hem of her dress. Lycomedes cleared his throat.
Are you married, my lord?
Diomedes half smiled.
For now.
His eyes never left the women. When the dance had finished, Odysseus stood, his voice raised for all to hear.
We are truly honored by your performance. Not everyone can say that they have seen the dancers of Scyros. As tokens of our admiration, we have brought gifts for you and your king.
A murmur of excitement,
Luxuries did not come often to Skyros. No one here had the money to buy them.
You are too kind.
Lycomedes' face was flushed with genuine pleasure. He had not expected this generosity. The servants brought trunks forth at Odysseus's signal and began unloading them on the long tables. I saw the glitter of silver, the shine of glass and gems. All of us, men and women both, leaned towards them, eager to see.
"Please, take what you would like," Odysseus said.
The girls moved swiftly to the tables, and I watched them fingering the bright trinkets. Perfumes in delicate glass bottles stoppered with a bit of wax. Mirrors with carved ivory for handles. Bracelets of twisted gold. Ribbons dyed deep in purples and reds. Among these were a few things I assumed were meant for Lycomedes and his counselors. Leather-bound shields, carved spear hafts, and silvered swords with supple kidskin sheaths. Lycomedes' eyes had caught on one of these, like a fish snagged by a line. Odysseus stood near, presiding benevolently. Achilles kept to the back, drifting slowly along the tables. He paused to dab some perfume on his slender wrists, stroke the smooth handle of a mirror. He lingered a moment over a pair of earrings, blue stones set in silver wire. A movement at the far end of the hall caught my eye. Diomedes had crossed the chamber and was speaking with one of his servants, who nodded and left through the large double doors. Whatever it was could not be important. Diomedes seemed half asleep, his eyes heavy-lidded and bored. I looked back to Achilles. He was holding the earrings up to his ears now, turning them this way and that, pursing his lips, playing at girlishness. It amused him, and the corner of his mouth curved up. His eyes flicked around the hall, catching for a moment on my face. I could not help myself. I smiled. A trumpet blew, loud and panicked. It came from outside, a sustained note, followed by three short blasts. Our signal for utmost impending disaster. Lycomedes lurched to his feet, the guards' heads jerked towards the door. Girls screamed and clung to each other, dropping their treasures to the ground in tinkles of breaking glass. All the girls but one. Before the final blast was finished, Achilles had swept up one of the silvered swords and flung off its kidskin sheath. The table blocked his path to the door. He leapt it in a blur, his other hand grabbing a spear from it as he passed. He landed, and the weapons were already lifted, held with a deadly poise that was like no girl, nor no man either. The greatest warrior of his generation. I yanked my gaze to Odysseus and Diomedes, and was horrified to see them smiling.
"Greetings, Prince Achilles," Odysseus said. "We've been looking for you."
I stood helpless, as the faces of Lycomedes' court registered Odysseus's words, turned towards Achilles, stared. For a moment, Achilles did not move. Then slowly, he lowered the weapons.
"Lord Odysseus," he said. His voice was remarkably calm. "Lord Diomedes?"
He inclined his head politely, one prince to another.
"I am honored to be the subject of so much effort."
It was a good answer, full of dignity and the slightest twist of mockery. It would be harder for them to humiliate him now.
"I assume you wish to speak with me. Just a moment and I will join you."
He placed the sword and spear carefully on the table. With steady fingers, he untied the kerchief, drew it off. His hair, revealed, gleamed like polished bronze. The men and women of Lycomedes' court whispered to one another in muted scandal. Their eyes clung to his figure.
"Perhaps this will help."
Odysseus had claimed a tunic from some bag or box. He tossed it to Achilles, who caught it.
"Thank you,"
Achilles said. The court watched, hypnotized as he unfolded it, stripped to the waist, and drew it over himself. Odysseus turned to the front of the room.
"Lycomedes, may we borrow a room of state, please? We have much to discuss with the Prince of Thyre."
Lycomedes' face was a frozen mask. I knew he was thinking of Thetis and punishment. He did not answer.
"Lycomedes!"
Diomede's voice was sharp, cracking like a blow.
Yes,
Lycomedes croaked. I pitied him. I pitied all of us.
Yes, just through there,
he pointed. Odysseus nodded. Thank you. He moved towards the door, confidently, as if never doubting but that Achilles would follow.
After you,
Diomedes smirked. Achilles hesitated, and his eyes went to me, just the barest glance.
Oh, yes,
Odysseus called over his shoulder.
You're welcome to bring Patroclus along, if you like. We have business with him as well.
Chapter 15. The room had a few threadbare tapestries and four chairs. I forced myself to sit straight against the stiff wood back, as a prince should. Achilles' face was tight with emotion, and his neck flushed.
It was a trick, he accused.
Odysseus was unperturbed.
You were clever in hiding yourself. We had to be cleverer still in finding you.
Achilles lifted an eyebrow in princely hauteur.
Well, you found me. What do you want?
We want you to come to Troy, Odysseus said.
And if I do not want to come?
Then we make this known.
Diomedes lifted Achilles' discarded dress. Achilles flushed as if he'd been struck. It was one thing to wear a dress out of necessity, another thing for the world to know of it. Our people reserved their ugliest names for men who acted like women. Lives were lost over such insults. Odysseus held up a restraining hand.
We are all noble men here, and it should not have to come to such measures. I hope we can offer you happier reasons to agree. Fame, for instance. You will win much of it if you fight for us.
There will be other wars. Not like this one, said Diomedes. This will be the greatest war of our people, remembered in legend and song for generations. You are a fool not to see it.
I see nothing but a cuckolded husband and Agamemnon's greed.
Then you are blind. What is more heroic than to fight for the honor of the most beautiful woman in the world against the mightiest city of the East? Perseus cannot say he did so much, nor Jason. Heracles would kill his wife again for a chance to come along. We will master Anatolia all the way to Araby. We will carve ourselves into stories for ages to come.
I thought you said it would be an easy campaign, home by next fall, I managed. I had to do something to stop the relentless roll of their words.
I lied, Odysseus shrugged. I have no idea how long it will be.
Faster if we have you. He looked at Achilles, his dark eyes pulled like the tide, however you swam against it.
The sons of Troy are known for their skill in battle, and their deaths will lift your name to the stars. If you miss it, you will miss your chance at immortality. You will stay behind, unknown. You will grow old, and older in obscurity.
Achilles frowned.
You cannot know that.
Actually, I can. He leaned back in his chair. I am fortunate to have some knowledge of the gods. He smiled, as if at a memory of some divine mischief. And the gods have seen fit to share with me a prophecy about you. I should have known that Odysseus would not come with tawdry blackmail as his only coin. The stories named him Polytropos, the man of many turnings. Fear stirred in me like ash.
What prophecy? Achilles asked slowly.
That if you do not come to Troy, your godhead will wither in you unused. Your strength will diminish. At best, you will be like Lycomedes here, mouldering on a forgotten island with only daughters to succeed him. Skyros will be conquered soon by a nearby state. You know this as well as I. They will not kill him. Why should they? He can live out his years in some corner, eating the bread they soften for him, senile and alone. When he dies, people will say, "Who?" The words filled the room, thinning the air until we could not breathe. Such a life was a horror. But Odysseus's voice was relentless. He is known now only because of how his story touches yours.
If you go to Troy, your fame will be so great that a man will be written into eternal legend just for having passed a cup to you. You will be...
The doors blew open in a fury of